I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Julie, what would it take to be a martyr? Like what are the qualities that one needs?
Let's see. Well, you wouldn't want to be someone who's too...
And I mean a real martyr, not... I mean, just like just...
Yes.
Like dripping off the page, stained glass window kind of a thing.
Yes.
Gory pages of a history book.
Okay. All right.
Here's I'm not just talking like, oh, he's a martyr because he refuses to use the new coffee machine.
Right. You're not going, hey, get off that cross. Someone needs the wood.
Yeah.
It's not one of those martyrs. Okay. First of all, you probably don't want to be too concerned with materialism. I'm going to say you don't want to be a big shopper, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you'd be willing to wear a potato sack, kind of be a little bit smelly. Sit in one position for a long time, sort of meditating on the world and your purpose, right?
Right.
What would make if this was a want ad, what else would we stick in there?
You have to be extremely committed to an idea or a belief.
Right.
Something.
Must have high ideals.
Yes. So something that, again, is stronger than, ooh, I have to play this new video game when it comes out next month, and stronger even than one's own natural affinity for life itself.
Okay. Must be able to withstand extreme pain in various forms and possible death.
Yes, and I think this is the aspect of it that interests me the most at this moment, anyway. And it's certainly what we're going to spend the most time with in this podcast, because growing up, I've always been fascinated by these images of martyrs, especially in the Catholic tradition. As someone in the Western world, you just kind of grow up seeing these things,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, be it in actual like church literature or studying like the history of Western civilization. You just see all these just gory images. It probably pays to just quickly also just to define where we get the word martyr.
Okay, yeah.
It comes from the late Greek term martyr, which comes from martus, witness, and the idea is that you're witnessing something, you're bearing testimony to some fact or faith
mm-hmm.
with your blood.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I think that's the crux of it right there. Because the end game of being a martyr is not necessarily to die, right? But I think one of the things that is so...
Well, anybody can die. Everybody dies.
Well, exactly. But to actually try to do it so that your you know, immortalized and celebrated. I mean, it's just sort of a byproduct, like, oops, I might die. And so I think, but this is one of the most intriguing things about a martyr, at least it captures our attention and why it's so dramatic, is that these are people who are so committed to something that they are willing to withstand such pain.
It also turns the typical social and just even evolutionary contract on its head, you know, because it's suddenly like, here's the person that that when the authority said, hey, you need to do this or we'll kill you, he said, go ahead. I believe more in the idea that I should have this freedom, or that I should be able to say this, that, or the other, or live this, that, or the other. I believe in this more than I believe in the importance of my own skin.
Oh, yeah, or that Joan of Arc, for instance, she had such a strong vision from God that King Charles VII should be, you know, put on the throne, that she was willing to suffer death, and you know, of course, was burned at the stake. So this is pretty heavy stuff in that respect, and it really is very interesting from a psychological perspective of pain, because we know that psychological factors play a huge role in the perception of pain.
Right. Now, but before we break down some of the psychology and the science of this, let's run through a few examples. And it's important to note that so much in martyrdom and in the history of martyrs in any culture, in any religious tradition or secular tradition, we're talking about something that has to do with the politics of memory. I mean, these are ultimately, they may have been people at one point or another, but they become stories. And stories are told by individuals with a bias of some sort. So a person may die truly believing in something. They may die a martyr. But if no one's going to tell the story, then they're not really a martyr.
Right. So in other words, we're going to talk about a couple of martyrs just as examples. But that doesn't mean that these people necessarily perform certain tasks, or maybe were even that suffered. I mean, I guess what we're trying to say here is that there could be some fictionalization of things that are not that well documented in the past. And we're not celebrating martyrism. Martyrdom. We just think it's fascinating.
Yeah. It is pretty cool in a very morbid way to me too. That's my personal opinion. But, all right. You have Saint Antipas of Pergamum. Roasted to death in a bronze bull in 92 AD. Yeah, which is like a big bronze bull, and when you put somebody in it. And then apparently as they're shrieking and dying inside the bull, it makes this echoed sound. So that the bronze bull sounds like an actual bull.
This makes sense because way back in the day, this was big pageantry, right? Like you wanted good acoustics on this.
Well, and this is key too, pageantry. Most of your martyr deaths, especially the big ones out of medieval tradition, they tend to be pretty dramatic because there's a lot of drama caught up in the whole martyrdom idea. Isaiah is pretty interesting. This was an 8th century BC prophet in the kingdom of Judea. This is Old Testament stuff. But he was rebranded in the Middle Ages as this martyr that was sawed in half right down the middle with this big kind of tooth saw. And what's really fascinating about this dude is if you look at some of these medieval texts, the way that he is depicted, they make a kind of cruciform image with like the saw going across and his body up and down. So it ends up looking like a cross. So he's rebranded as this Christian saint, which is interesting and tells us a lot about the idea of martyrdom, again, as politics.
Right.
Memory,
you didn't think there was that marketing existed way back then, but yeah, apparently.
Right. And then, another example from the medieval tradition, especially, would be Saint Bartholomew. This guy is said to have been martyred in Armenia. And accounts vary on exactly what was done. In one, he was beheaded, and then others, he's crucified upside down. But the most popular tradition holds that he was flayed alive, that he was skinned.
Ouchie wawa.
Yeah. So in various works of art and in one really stunning, statue that was made in 1562, you see him depicted as this skinless man, like something out of Hellraiser, or that Robbie Williams video that I sent you the other day, where he's stripping and then he strips off his skin and he's dancing around.
So unprepared for that. I was lulled into submission there.
What do you think was going to happen? Because he was already down to his underwears, right?
I guess it was just like the beat and the, hey, DJ. I just didn't think it was going to be like, okay, he's going to self-flay himself.
Yeah. So he tends to be depicted like that, with a flaying knife in one hand and his own skin thrown over his shoulder. This is Bartholomew, not Robbie Williams.
St. Bart, yep.
Yeah. And he tends to have this look on his face, especially in that statue. It's like a serene look, like a look like, hey,
this doesn't hurt.
Yeah, so I skinned myself, big deal.
It's just a flesh wound.
Yeah, which again comes down to that whole, like, the idea of the martyr as turning the typical rules of pain and suffering on their head.
Mm-hmm.
You see accounts among various Native American peoples where there's a certain amount of torture that ends up playing into some of these tribal groups, and it becomes part of this culture. And you have these stories of individuals who were captured, individuals from rival groups.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were tortured, they didn't cry out or they didn't say anything, and in doing so, shamed their tormentors.
And we'll talk a little bit about that too, how we actually have some cases of this that are documented.
Right.
But let's just talk about a couple of modern martyr examples of what some people think of as martyrs.
Yes. One in particular, especially would be Thich Quang Duc, mm-hmm. the Vietnamese Buddhist monk who burned himself to death on a busy Saigon intersection on June 11th, 1963. Everyone has probably seen an image of this before because it's one of the most iconic images of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Malcolm Brown won a Pulitzer Prize for the photo, and it's, you know, this black and white stark image of this figure seated in like a meditative position, legs folded, and just engulfed in flames.
Right. And reports, eyewitnesses say that he never screamed. There was some flinching, of course, but that's, you know, of course, going to happen with your muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And your skin reacting to that. But, he practiced a very severe ascetic lifestyle, and he, had an extreme meditation practice. It was considered a bodhisattva. I know I'm saying that wrong. But at the time of his death, and that essentially that he was enlightened. So, again, here's an example of withstanding extreme pain.
Right. And that one's more interesting that it is a more contemporary example. Because again, it often, you can imagine like somebody dying horribly for a cause. And then the people who carry that cause, of course, they're going to say, oh, but he or she was bigger than the pain because the cause is that important. This is one of the themes that's explored in Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose that I've always found really interesting. There's a martyred heretic that is not a character in the book, but is referred to a lot. This Fra Delsino, who is a 13th century poverty heretic, believed that the church should be poor, that everyone should be poor, and should renounce all material possessions.
Mm-hmm.
And so the young character in the book encounters one telling of the tale in which he rises above the pain and is serene through all these savage things that are done to him. And then in another account that is supposedly the true account, we learn that the individual died just a really horrible death and responded in the way, typical way one might.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we have one more modern martyr to mention, right?
Yeah, Mahatma Gandhi. Now, some people might say, well, I don't know that I consider Mahatma Gandhi a true martyr, while other people say, actually, this is a really good example of a martyr because this is someone who campaigned for home rule in India and helped to defeat colonialism and did that as in a similar way that you had talked about, which was kind of shaming the government and doing that through hunger strikes. He was in prison several times and he was whittled down to the bone. I mean, we're not talking like he just denied himself a piece of cheesecake. I mean, this is another form of pain to endure.
Right.
And you'll actually see, this is really interesting. They've seen studies before that people who are anorexic actually have, less susceptibility to pain because you do sort of get in this mindset where you're denying your body, and you're living in this kind of extreme situation. But, you know, it's interesting to look at Mahatma Gandhi, and although he did die, and he was actually murdered by a fellow Hindu who was disappointed that Gandhi could not stop the partitioning between Pakistan and India. Essentially, what we're talking about here is Hindus versus Muslims, right? He was martyred in a certain way. I guess some people could perceive that because of his commitment to sort of saying an ecumenical, way of embracing all cultures and all religions. So again, another example, you know, he wasn't, we're not talking about skin flaying here. But these are, you know, extreme acts, done by people.
Yeah. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to really head into the science of all this and to what some of the various neuroscientists and psychologists have to say about the way that we experience pain and how various martyrs in the past may have overcome this suffering.
This podcast is brought to you by Intel, the sponsors of tomorrow, and the Discovery Channel. At Intel, we believe curiosity is the spark which drives innovation. Join us at curiosity.com and explore the answers to life's questions.
All right, we're back. And Julie, you have something to share about the Shaolin monks.
Yeah, I want to talk Kung Fu.
Like, we're talking real Shaolin monks, not the film Shaolin monks.
No. Okay. We're talking the real thing, the ones that inspire martial arts movies, really.
Okay.
Shaolin monks, it's actually, they're a sect of Mahayana Buddhism monks, mm-hmm. and they're concerned with meditation and martial arts. And just a couple of facts to throw out there to give you some context about this. Kung Fu has been practiced in China since 200 BC, and it was always thought of as a practice of devotion. Okay, so that's really important here. And the leading Shaolin Kung Fu school was actually established 1,500 years ago, believe it or not. But these guys develop extraordinary physical skills through training over many, many years. And the basis of this is pain control or pain management. And they really acclimate themselves to be able to withstand this kind of pain. And some of it's through meditation.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it is actually through the Kung Fu. I mean, we are talking about, and this is going to sound kind of silly, almost like Chinese water torture in some respects, but, you know, punching a huge vat of beans for hours and hours because they know that, you know, the hands are so sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is to desensitize the nerves in your hands.
So it's about you feel enough pain that it mm-hmm. desensitizes the nerves in the same in a similar way that, say, if one abuses a substance, you end up sort of frying the pathways.
Yeah, but it's still pretty much like, you know, mind over matter. There's a 1934 book by Jin Jing Song entitled Training Methods of the 72 Arts of the Shaolin, and it documents a range of skills that can be acquired, such as causing internal damage to an opponent using a one-fingered punch.
Oh, the Buddha finger.
The Buddha finger, yes. Being able to perform handstands on two fingers and being able to break solid objects with the heel of the palm.
Uh-huh.
But they also, like, just for fun, they'll just take, like, you know, a stack of, like, five bricks on their head and someone will, like, karate chop them on their heads.
For fun?
For fun.
I don't know that sounds very Buddhist that they're doing it for
fun. I say that for fun because, you know, I was looking at some great video of them and essentially these are a bunch of 10-year-old kids
uh-huh.
and some of them start younger. And, you know, at the age of 10, they're getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and they're running up this hill in 20 minutes, actually a mountain that takes about an hour and a half for the average adult to scale. And then they're walking down hands and knees. Okay, this doesn't sound like fun, but still, I mean, this is, you know, that age, you have tons of energy, right?
Yeah. So walk up some mountains, break some bricks, and they're so much more well-behaved when they get back to the monastery.
Exactly. But it is fascinating to see this because they also have a yoga tradition in this. So mm-hmm. they're doing martial arts. They're doing these yoga moves and they are so well-disciplined. And I mean, they're doing these for hours and hours and these drills, these combat moves that they're essentially just imprinting in their brains and their bodies so that it becomes second nature. And one of the principles too is Qigong. I'm sure you've heard about this too. I believe it's a type of martial arts. And it's the idea that fire energy can actually emanate from your abdomen and you can.
This is like fire breath?
Kind of. And that you can actually direct it to, susceptible parts of your body or sensitive parts of your body, like your neck.
Uh-huh.
So you could direct this energy to your neck and then someone could punch the holiness out of your neck and you'd be completely fine. And they do this. Like these are the sort of tasks that they do on for hours.
Huh.
It's pretty amazing. But I mean, it sort of makes sense because that they could be able to do this because of that practice, the repetitive nature and meditation. If you think about meditation, your heart slows, you're pumping less blood, the muscles relax. And when you relax the muscles, this is really key because it means less tension and less tension means less pain. And I was just thinking about when we were doing some research on lightning strikes.
Uh-huh.
And I remember we came across something about a guy who was in the thralls of a tornado. And he was struck by a lamp. So he was rendered unconscious, but his body was thrown across the field and he was perfectly fine. And they think that's because he wasn't able to tense his body and react.
This is kind of like how you hear accounts of individuals in wrecks where intoxicated individuals end up surviving a wreck because they're not there enough to tense up.
Right. So imagine if you're this monk and you have gone through this incredible training, mind and body, then you could slow your heart rate and you have like these mad skills where, you know, you could defend yourselves or you defend yourself. And then if you were to be struck, you could negate that strike, you could negate that pain.
Wow.
Yeah. Dude.
Well, speaking of meditation, I ran across some stuff here by American psychiatrist Robert Lifton, who did a lot of work looking at like Holocaust survivors and all. Yale and Harvard guy, big medicine in the field. He described survivors of brainwashing and other psychological deprivation techniques applied by the Chinese government against captive missionaries. And he attributed their mental survival to practicing meditation, to recalling and reciting poetry, scripture, other literature. Essentially, they end up living in this imaginal process to expand a very limited, restricted physical environment. Which calls to mind, we did a previous episode about isolation, and about how when you're in an isolated environment, it begins to rather quickly play tricks on the mind. The mind is starved of stimuli and ends up having to grasp onto other things to get by.
Right. And that some of these people had actually cognitive deficiencies after having been isolated for years.
Yeah. And anyway, Lifton found that people who were able to in these situations of isolation and this is, you know, isolation is a form of torment, were able to reach out and just say, cling to this bit of scripture, cling to this prayer, cling to like create some imagined reality to make up for what's lacking in the physical environment. Which I found pretty interesting.
Which is a distraction for your mind, right?
Right.
Which we always have talked about how the mind needs a bone to chew on.
Right. And then, of course, there's self-hypnosis as well, which is an area that is less, I mean, hypnosis itself and exactly how it works is less understood than other aspects of pain management, for sure. But there have been studies into how IBS patients can use self-hypnosis. And this is, of course, irritable bowel syndrome. They found they can reduce contractions in the bowel, something that's not normally possible under conscious control. And their bowel lining also becomes less sensitive to pain.
Okay.
And I actually, when I was in college, I had an abnormal psychology professor. I mean, he was
teaching abnormal psychology.
Well, he was also a little abnormal, I guess. Right. But he mentioned that he was really into the idea of self hypnosis, and he said that he had worked with a former student who was having to go in and have this technique performed where they take the little camera and they stick it up the urethra into the bladder.
Oh my.
Yeah. And they were having to do it on a regular basis, and it was extremely painful for this guy, and they couldn't just put him under each time because it was a bit much to go on such a regular basis to be knocked out for this procedure. So he would freak out with the pain and they would have to hold him down and stuff, and it was just an ugly situation for everybody concerned. So they taught him, he began learning self-hypnosis, and supposedly by the end of the training, he was able to calm himself enough that he only felt the tip of the camera poking through into his bladder towards the end of the insertion.
Wow. Well, you know, I was thinking about this too, even with the placebo effect. We've talked about this, that this promise sometimes that the pain will be alleviated will automatically make the endorphins in your body kick in and opiates kick in. So sometimes it really is mind over matter. This is from a Scientific American article, Daring to Die. They were actually talking about the psychology of suicide, but this is certainly related. It says, it is not enough to want to die. To intentionally end their own life, people need the will to carry out their plans. This resolve depends on factors such as fearlessness and being able to tolerate pain and to act impulsively. The latest research shows that such fearlessness can be conditioned. Those who gain experience with pain, whether from abuse by others or by their own hands, gradually improve their ability to tolerate discomfort. They also get used to the idea of harming themselves.
Huh.
Which kind of plays into this question that has come up before when we've talked about this. You know, is someone a masochist or a martyr? At what point? You know, and another really interesting study came up. It's a 2009 study, and geneticist Moshe Sif of McGill University and his colleagues showed that childhood abuse appears to produce specific patterns of so-called epigenetic marks on the DNA of brain cells in people who later killed themselves.
Huh.
So it kind of, again, there's this relationship between pain and psychology in the body.
Well, speaking of masochism, which you mentioned there, I did run across some stuff from Don Richard Rizzo, who wrote a book called Personality Types Using the Enneagram for Self-Discovery. And he wrote about masochistic personality disorder is defined by the American Psychiatric Association.
Mm-hmm.
And there are various levels of it. But in one case, we're talking about an unhealthy level of masochistic personality disorder. They said that it can manifest as manipulative and self-serving, instilling guilt, putting others in debt, self-deceptive about one's own motives and behavior, domineering and coercive feelings, entitled to anything they want and others. And then they're having this like victim and martyr.
Okay, so it
conflict.
Tips the scales of power in a relationship. Like,
right.
I've suffered so greatly that therefore you should feel sorry for me and...
Yeah, and it
give me a candy bar now.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's there's sort of the opposite, the idea of people that are immune to pain.
Oh yes, okay. So I watching one of the Stieg Larsson movies.
Uh-huh. This is the girl who kicked the hornet's nest, the girl who touched the cat on the belly,
mm-hmm.
the girl who
set her hair on fire,
a sandwich in its wrapper. Yeah, all those.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, and I'm not gonna spoil any plots here, but that came up, and I thought that was really fascinating.
Huh. My dad was a dentist, and I remember him talking about having one patient that come in. You know, he would regularly, you know, if somebody comes in for a dental procedure, obviously you end up having to apply a topical anesthetic or even injecting something, you know, doing something to deal with the pain. Pain management comes with the territory of dentistry. But he had on one occasion in his, decades of experience, had one guy come in and they were preparing to do a fairly, painful procedure. Mm-hmm. I forget exactly what it was, but it was not just a cleaning by any stretch of the imagination. There was some actual digging around involved.
There was blood involved.
Right. And my dad was like, all right, well, you know, time to numb you up. And the guy was like, I'm good. And my dad was like, I don't think you are, because I really need to numb you up for this, because this is what's about to happen. And the guy's like, no, I never take any kind of, medicine when I come into the dentist. And, so my dad was like, oh, all right. You know, he's kind of begrudgingly agreed to at least start.
Yeah.
And ended up the guy didn't take any pain medication for the entire procedure. And my dad would talk about it. He was like, he said, I just felt weird doing it. I felt it,
right. Right.
You know, you felt like you're tormenting somebody, but they're not feeling any pain. And as it turns out, this was not just this one dude. There are, it's rare, but there are individuals who don't feel pain.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading a study from Dr. Geoff Woods, from the Cambridge Institute for Medical Research. And they ended up bringing together a number of children. Some of them had grown up or teenagers by the time the study came around. But growing up, they reported to never have felt pain. And they analyzed them, and they found there was nothing wrong with their nervous system. It mm-hmm. wasn't a situation where they had some sort of, you know, some sort of like leprosy type of a condition. They had normal intelligence. They had normal nerves, and the nerves seemed to conduct signals normally, and their brains seemed to be put together normally.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't make any sense based on their current theories of pain. But they were able to isolate a gene called SCN9A. That is very highly expressed in the pain-sensing nerves.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's been a number of research we're continuing to try and understand exactly
right.
how this gene plays into it. But they found that people who don't feel pain as well or at all, they also may not be able to detect certain odors.
Mm-hmm.
And they've also found that this is from another study, the Cambridge Institute for Medical Research. They found that people who suffer from osteoarthritis,
mm-hmm.
patients that reported higher levels of pain were more likely to carry a particular DNA base at certain locations in this same gene, SCN9A.
Oh, okay.
So we see the opposite there, where it sort of tweaked another direction, and it creates a higher sensitivity for pain. So there's
to boil it down to like the most basic, it's like there's a connection missing between that perception of pain
right.
and that nerve.
Right. It's highly possible that some martyrs in the past
right.
May have just been in a particular situation genetically to where
mm-hmm.
they did not feel pain as strongly or at all, which would certainly help you if you were, say, to be, boiled alive.
That's just cheating.
Well, I guess it is. But then... believing in something strong enough to escape from your torments, that's kind of cheating too. That's the whole thing. Martyrs are cheating the system.
Right.
And sticking it to the man.
So like these days though, instead of like being you can still obviously be a martyr in many different ways, but maybe you would just do like a sideshow act with like the Jim Rose circus.
Yes, but then you're it's like you said, to be a martyr at the top of the podcast, to be a martyr, you can't be that concerned with material possessions.
Yes.
And if you're cashing in on your inability to feel pain, then you just clearly weren't set out for martyrdom, even if you have some very cool key skills there to implement.
It's not your bag.
Yeah. You mentioned endorphins earlier. Mm-hmm. Endorphins are, of course, this natural painkiller that's released in the brain. And there have been studies that shown that practices such as prayer and meditation actually can help further release these endorphins and, in theory, the pain threshold.
Yeah, and this was interesting. This is from the lab. Researchers at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and UCLA have shown that rats don't respond to painful stimuli in the presence of a predator or when the rats are in an environment that provokes fear because, say, they had previously experienced a painful stimulus in it and they experience released opioids, again, natural painkillers, from their cells. So it's almost like it was hard-coded once they had the experience. And, you know, if it's a sense of danger could actually squelch pain in rats. But, you know, certainly you can take that information and apply it to humans and, you know, possibly the same sort of conditions could be met.
And also there's something to be said about this. When you feel the endorphins released by pain, you can sort of feel like a rush. Say if you're getting a tattoo or something.
Yeah.
There's a certain, like, high you end up getting just from the discomfort of the procedure that I can't help but think on some level might play into some of this transcendence of pain. You know, I'm granted getting a tattoo is rather different from being boiled alive or roasted in a brazen bowl.
No, but it is all psychological, right? Because and I've read something about that too, that again, this sort of that high, that reward, that it depends on if you're, you know what it is you're holding out for or enduring. Maybe it is to be, you know, immortalized.
Right.
And again, the endorphins are hitting and it feels like, oh, okay, well, yes, I'm, or you're an athlete. This is a good example.
Right.
You're running through the pain,
because
you're motivated to do it. You're motivated to win.
Feel the burn, right?
Yeah, feel the burn. And you're also getting a bit of a high.
Yeah.
So, it sort of depends on what's on the other side, I suppose.
I've also heard some, athletes, sort of hobby athletes who have discussed how when they're pushing themselves really hard, they also feel like they're kind of punishing themselves. So I can see that also kind of playing into.
So it's sort of like a transcendence in a weird way of their physicality, but maybe some sort of, I don't know, psychological, spiritual level.
Yeah. It brings to mind this, this quick quote from Rumi, the 13th century Persian Muslim poet. He said, "Pain is an alchemy that renovates. Where is indifference when pain intercedes? Beware. Do not sigh coldly in your indifference. Seek pain. Seek pain, pain, pain."
I love that because I always think of Rumi as being this incredibly romantic poet.
Yeah, most of what you hear from Rumi is very romantic. Certainly not pain, pain, pain.
Yeah, yeah. But it is interesting. I mean, we are so highly motivated by pain, and it certainly helps us learn, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so much of our experiences of becoming a human are all about avoiding pain.
Yeah.
And our actions are certainly derived from that motivation.
Yeah, indeed.
So now that we've wrapped up martyrs and pain, let's see what sort of non-painful stuff has come through the mail.
Oh, you want me to pull from the non-painful listener mail pile?
I didn't know we had a painful one.
We do have a painful folder, yeah. Luckily, it's not very big, but we have a few painful emails in there. No, but this is from the good pile. We heard from Gabriel. Gabriel writes in and says, "Dynamic duo, Robert and Julie." Hey, that's
us.
Yeah. Says, "Greetings from Iraq. I am writing at you today from the Center of Civilization, a.k.a. the Fertile Crescent, Iraq. I am a combat engineer in the U.S. Army on my second combat tour. I have had the opportunity to have wireless internet and have been able to download many of your podcasts, and I listen to each evening. During the day, while on patrol in MRAP, that's Mine Resistant Armored Patrol Vehicle, I replay the podcast I listened to the night before over the headset. It is great for breaking up the monotony of looking for IEDs and talking about the usual Army-related stories. My soldiers have learned about many interesting things, including wasps and bees, brain wiping, and microdrones. They especially like the episode on nightmares killing people. After spending almost an entire year in the southern part of Iraq near the Iranian border, I have often wondered what made this region of the world such a good spot for the beginning of civilization. I read recently that this part of Iraq, the Fertile Crescent, has changed significantly since the days of Mesopotamia. and that its present environmental condition could not support the civilizations that existed long ago. Have you ever considered a podcast discussing this fact? In summary, on behalf of myself and my soldiers, I just wanted to extend our thanks to the both of you. Sitting in a convoy of vehicles with the same guys for almost 12 hours a day is kind of like taking a year-long road trip, but on the same roads. Almost like a Twilight Zone episode. In your own way, you're both doing great things for your country.
Gabriel. Oh, man, that was really nice.
That's a really nice
Thanks,
one.
Gabriel. That's, wow, and what a description, too. I had never thought about that. It's like this sort of like road trip analogy.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. I think that the Fertile Crescent is fascinating. That's definitely one that we're going to need to cover because, I mean, we can talk about that from so many different perspectives, archaeological, cultural, and so on. So thanks.
Yeah, and by all means, thank you for your service to our country.
Yeah, absolutely.
All you guys, if you happen to be listening right now. So if anyone would like to share anything with us, there are many ways to get in touch with us. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter. We're Blow the Mind on both of those.
And you can also drop us an email at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.